Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Shane Claiborne, author, theologian, popular speaker, and founder of Red Letter Christians, which I highly recommend if you haven't checked it out, redletterchristians.org, and the Simple Way Community. And we're going to talk about following the nonviolent Jesus through public organizing, action, and resistance. This podcast is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing peace and justice and nonviolence and working for a more just, peaceful world. So let's begin with a little two-second prayer. So I invite all those who are listening, wherever you are, to just take a deep breath and to relax and to recenter yourself. And together, let's all enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you infinitely and personally, and every human being, all our sisters and brothers. And let's welcome the nonviolent Jesus here with us now and ask for the grace to follow him ever more faithfully that we might do God's will of peace and justice. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life and love and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect on the nonviolence of Jesus and how we can better follow him today as activists, organizers, and nonviolent resistors in this culture of violence and greed and death and destruction. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will and proclaim your way of peace, love, justice, and nonviolence, that we might all together do our part to help you end war, poverty, violence, racism, greed, oligarchy, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction, that we might be your beatitude people of universal love, universal compassion, and universal peace. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, it's my great pleasure today to welcome my friend Shane Claiborne. Shane, I think, is one of the great peacemakers of our time. He graduated from Eastern University and did graduate work at Princeton Seminary. His adventures have taken him from the streets of Calcutta, where he worked with Mother Teresa, to the wealthy suburbs of Chicago, where he served at the mega church Willow Creek. As a peacemaker, he's been in some of the most troubled places in the world, from Rwanda to the West Bank, to serious time in Iraq, and together we went to Afghanistan. Shane heads up Red Letter Christians, as I said, a movement of Christians committed to living out the lifestyle prescribed in the Gospels. And Shane is the founder of The Simple Way, a community in inner city Philadelphia. He's married to Katie Joe, and they have a new baby boy. Shane writes and travels extensively, speaking about peacemaking, social justice, and Jesus. His many best-selling books include Jesus for President, Red Letter Revolution, Common Prayer, Follow Me to Freedom, Jesus Bombs and Ice Cream, Becoming the Answer to Our Prayers, Executing Grace, which is a brilliant book on the death penalty, and Beating Guns, which is a brilliant book on gun violence, and then his great classic work, The Irresistible Revolution. His newest book is Rethinking Life. Shane, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, my brother, it is so good. I'm still praying that may we be your beatitude people.
Well, come on, Shane. Isn't that great? So we're going to jump right into the deep end, okay?
I'm ready.
All right.
So I expect nothing less.
We're going to need several hours, dear friends who are listening. The two of us, once we get going. We're up to our ears in oligarchy, an empire, and white supremacy, and injustice, and corporate greed, and permanent warfare, and lies, and nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction. Hey, I'm not done. Trump, the Republican Party, Fox News, I can go on and on. Meanwhile, here we are called to follow the most radical nonviolent revolutionary in history, Jesus of Nazareth. So that's why I thought, last week, Brian McLaren was teaching us about authoritarianism. Mm. And next week, I'm going to talk about Luke 10, how Jesus built a bottom-up grassroots movement. And I wanted to hear you reflect on following Jesus through public organizing and action and resistance, which you do so well. So I wanted to first invite you. Basically, it's the topic of how we as Christians have to become activists, organizers, and nonviolent resistors as part of our faith life, as disciples of Jesus. I always say, I know this is stupid, Shane, but Jesus did not sit back and do nothing. He got up and went forward and took on the empire and led a movement, and we have to do the same. So can you reflect on any way you want to start on the nonviolence of Jesus, Jesus as a resistor, an activist, and an organizer, and going public, as Dan Berrigan taught me?
Oh, goodness. Well, the place I would start is, I mean, for me, John, as you know, a part of what happens is the closer we are to the pain, the more urgent it is to respond to it. And so I think a lot of times in the church, it's not so much a compassion problem as a proximity problem and a relationship disconnect, because we've grown a little bit distant from the people who are most impacted by injustice. And so one of the starting points for me is being near to those who are hurting. You know, Mother Teresa, she once said, it can be very fashionable to talk about the poor, but not as fashionable to talk to them, to know them. Yeah. And so, I mean, for me, that's been what puts a fire in my bones around so many of these issues, is being in relationship with the people who are impacted, you know, knowing the guys on death row that are facing execution, living in a neighborhood where we have, you know, almost in every corner, a memorial to someone who was a victim of gun violence. And so, you know, I think that's a part of it. And Dr. King, you know, who's a great teacher of both of ours, one of the things he said is we're all called to be the Good Samaritan and lift our neighbor out of the ditch. But after you lift so many people out of the ditch, you start to say, maybe we need to do something about the whole road to Jericho, right? Let's do something about why people keep ending up in the ditch. So that nearness to the pain is at the heart of the gospel. I mean, you know, that God left all the comfort of heaven to join the suffering here on earth and was born into a brown-skinned Palestinian Jewish refugee baby who was homeless and came from a town where people said nothing good could come. So we've got to lean into the margins as God does. And then the other thing I think is, I one of the things I always love about hanging out with you, John, is how much you love Jesus. And I grew up in the evangelical Bible Belt in East Tennessee. But the deeper I fell in love with Jesus, the more at odds I found myself with evangelical Christianity and the priorities and the contradictions that I saw there. So, you know, I think we've got to keep centering Jesus when we take our eyes off Jesus, we can end up focusing on things that Jesus did not focus on and forgetting the things that Jesus had a whole lot to say about. So, you know, the Beatitudes and Matthew 25, all of these are show us God's deep concern for the most vulnerable people in our nation.
Wow, Shane, that was beautiful. Thank you. I could listen to you all day. No, it's so helpful. I'm just going to go on with the questions I prepared for you, but you can say whatever you want. You know, when I think about my own journey, wow, when I was a kid, Shane, and in college at Duke and made this decision to become a Jesuit and a priest, I never thought it that meant I'd have to become an activist or an organizer or a public speaker, much less a nonviolent resistor and an ex-con with a long rap sheet. But nobody told me. And I studied the Gospels, and then I had teachers like you did, Dan and Phil Berrigan, Tutu, Mother Teresa, Nat Han, and then these mythic figures, Gandhi, Dr. King, and Dorothy Day. And that's what they did. And, like, you know, I was living in El Salvador working with the homeless, and as you said, you get moving. What happened to you? How did you end up like this? And how can we help other Christians, you know, as Dan told me, go public and start organizing, taking action, standing up, speaking out, and resisting what Brian McLaren called the rising tide of authoritarianism?
So the backdrop of, you know, growing up in East Tennessee for me gives me a little bit of patience with other folks, because on so many issues that I feel deeply convicted and passionate about, ending the death penalty, gun violence, ending militarism and war, nuclear weapons, I spent a lot of my life on the other side of those issues. I was for the death penalty. I had all the Bible verses that I thought, you know, justified the death penalty. My dad was a veteran. My whole family are still gun owners. So I grew up with guns. And so I think part of what I began to do is deconstruct some of those things, but I also began to see that there's a version of self-righteousness that's also in progressive circles. So we've got to be careful not to just have this sense of moral superiority that doesn't have room for grace and transformation and for people to change their minds. So I still love dialoguing with people who disagree with me. And I have a lot of patience for folks that, you know, have Bible verses that defend the death penalty, because I use those same arguments. So I think, you know, self-righteousness is toxic, but then, you know, the closer we get to the pain, the more we can't help but respond. So when it comes to activism, I mean, I can remember distinctively, John, you know, when there was a 19-year-old that was killed right in front of our house, and I heard the gunshots, I ran outside. At the time, he was still alive, so I was holding his hand, I was praying with him. The ambulance came, he was still fighting for every breath, and then the next day, we found out that he didn't make it. And for me, that was the moment where compassion and love compelled me to also care about justice and policies. And, you know, I think that as I think of loving my neighbor as myself, it means I also care about the principalities and powers that are crushing their lives, that are keeping them from flourishing. You did a great montage of those, you know, up front, naming some names of the principalities and powers that we're up against. So, I mean, I think the best organizing centers those that are impacted. And as our brother Cornel West says, it lets the suffering speak, amplify the suffering. And Dr. King's, you know, entire philosophy of organizing was, we've got to amplify the suffering so that it makes people who are in power uncomfortable. And we've got to expose injustice so that those who have the power to change it are activated. And I think the way that we do that is we've got to, like, move people's hearts and minds. And, you know, that's why love is a compelling force that Dr. King talks so much about. We will wear them down by our love, no matter how much they hate us. You know, Dr. King said, you can burn down our houses, you can threaten the lives of our children, you can throw us in jail and put your dogs on us, but we will still love you and we will wear you down by our love. So that refusal to allow people to change our hearts to make us hate them is a powerful thing to claim. It's to say, you know, this is about who we are. We've seen too much hate to hate, as Dr. King said. Hate's too big a burden to bear, because hate does something to us. Self-righteousness does something to us. So I think that humility, that's at the heart of nonviolence. Now, I think when it comes to organizing, John, I love to be creative. And you just had Brian on the show. Brian McLaren's one of the first people that I think used the word, we don't just need to protest, we need to protestify. We need to proclaim, you know, a vision for a better world. So that's always been my, you know, organizing tactic is let's proclaim how the world could be. Let's cast a vision for a better world. And, you know, as Walter Brueggemann called it, the prophetic imagination. Let's invite people to not just imagine a better world, but to build it together.
That's all great, Shane. But, you know, Martin King was a brilliant organizer, and he was able to energize and mobilize people. And so was Gandhi, and so was Jesus. And, you know, you are one of the most creative people I know, and I'm serious to the friends who are listening to this to check out Shane's work at redletterchristians.org. It's amazing. He's got so many things going, and he's living in poverty, and he's got all these friends, and they're doing stuff. So an example, and I want, maybe you could talk about it. I'm pushing this question about, you know, we all feel so helpless, there's nothing we can do. And you just say, no, we're going to get out there and do some. So about 8-9 years ago, Shane called me on the phone and goes, okay, John, I need you to come to D.C. and get arrested with me. We're going to get arrested. And I went, okay, because, you know, Shane's call. And in fact, we had one of the great demonstrations at the Supreme Court to mark the 40th anniversary of the death penalty, and 18 of us were arrested. Several had been on death row and all. But you were organizing that, Shane, as well as then participating in it and then using that as a way to protestify. And how did that happen again? And how do you keep going with that? Organizing, taking action, and encouraging others to publicly resist, because we're going to need this as the time, as we go forward more than ever, as the world gets worse.
Well, the power of organizing, I think, is we're bringing all of our ideas together. We're asking the question of how can we move people's hearts and minds. So just to remember that witness together, brother, it was so beautiful, because we created, you know, I think of protest at its best as a form of liturgy, a public lament, yeah. a public call. There's almost a worshipful piece of it when it's done at its best. It's a little bit of street theater too. It's using visuals and sound. So, you know, during that particular protest, there was a couple of things that we did. We recognized all of the lives that have been killed by our government in what we call the modern era of executions, right? This last 40 years or so. And so there were over 1,500 names. With each year, we listed the names of people executed on placards, you know, and we held those. But we also said, you know, to be against the death penalty is not to be against justice or to believe that someone should be able to murder someone without consequences or to be numb to the victim. So we also remembered the victims, and we carried roses in two colors, one for the victims of murder and violent crime, and the other one to remember the victims of execution and the folks on death row. And even in our lineup, as we, you know, carried out that prayerful witness, we laid the roses on the steps of the Supreme Court. And the folks that crossed over that line included, you know, our brother Derek Jameson, who spent 20 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit. Suzanne Bosler, whose father was a pastor that was violently killed, and she survived that crime. So we're centering the people who have so much credibility because they've experienced the twisted ideology of the death penalty, you know, firsthand. So, you know, I think of that's a part of what we're always trying to do is craft a prayerful service. And we just did it recently. I hope you'll come out this year and get arrested on Good Friday, John. But, you know, at the
See, friends, Martin, this is what I'm dealing with.
Lockheed Martin, the biggest weapons contractor in the world, where the weapons that are being used in Gaza are manufactured. We, on Good Friday, when we remember the death of Jesus on the cross, and ironically call it Good Friday, right? We gathered at Lockheed Martin, and we had a prayerful protest, and we carried the names of all of the children that we knew the names of that had been killed in Gaza. And we, you know, held a sign that said, Lockheed Martin, you have blood on your hands. And we put red handprints on a banner as a memorial. You know, and also like nodding back at the scripture and the death of Jesus, that folks tried to wash their hands and pretend that things were okay and that they hadn't done anything wrong. And so, so I think those are, you know, that's how I kind of think of our public witness. And of course, coming out of the rich tradition that you do of the Catholic Workers and the Plowshares movement and, you know, movements around the world that have always had an element of hope and joy in the midst of their public lament.
Wow, Shane. Well, I'm hoping this is the first of many conversations on the Nonviolent Jesus podcast with you. And there, Shane is involved in so many causes and movements, and that's why I wanted to focus on this, which I realize is a little different. And I don't even know where to begin, but let me list some of them and let you, Shane, tell us about anything you want to. So you've heard some about Shane's work to abolish the death penalty, whether through civil disobedience, and he's written an excellent book, his work to fight poverty and solidarity with the poor living in really inner city Philadelphia with the Simple Way, his peace activism. Well, that doesn't say it at all. Shane's experience in Iraq and the time we had together in Afghanistan listening to the youth who survived our drone warfare. But these demonstrations, at like the one at Lockheed Martin and other places, Shane has gone. Meanwhile, his whole book and campaign to end gun violence in the U.S., working with our friend at rawtools.org to literally get people to turn in their guns and beat them into gardening tools. And just in general, I see, Shane, all your writing, your longtime public speaking, Shane always seems to be on the road, and your community building and life and your building, bringing always people together, all that creativity, are also part of your nonviolent resistance, your Christian witness. Tell us about any of these things to encourage us to keep going and doing that. I don't even know where to begin, Shane. So, you know,
Well, I mean, there's so many ways I think that we can all collaborate and team up. Sometimes at Red Letter Christians, we say, John, you know, that we're a web of subversive friends.
That's that are great.
You know, conspiring together for Jesus and justice. So folks can always find out. We've got a whole section of our website on how to take action. So, you know, the upcoming event on Good Friday this year at Lockheed Martin, we'll be doing again around every execution that takes place in the United States. We have both, it's a hybrid protest. So both online and in person on the ground, we support folks in protesting those executions, the spirit of nonviolence and the spirit of love, and kind of proclaiming that violence is the problem, not the solution. So we can't kill to try to show that killing is wrong. So folks can join us at Death Penalty Action or Red Letter Christians. We have announcements. We have an alert that goes out before every execution in America. And then with the gun stuff, you know, this is what's so tragic too, is that gun violence is now the number one cause of death of young people in America, more than car accidents or cancer. And so you cannot be pro-life and ignore gun violence. Every one of those a precious child of God. So it's over 100 lives a day that are cut short by guns, and 40,000 lives a year. In my lifetime, John, like I'm 50 years old this year. In my lifetime, we've lost more lives to gun violence domestically than in all the casualties of all of America's wars combined. Wow. And we're all working on nuclear weapons and the escalating violence in Gaza and the Middle East. And yet we're, you know, around the gun violence, we're responding. And you like this. We got our name, Raw Tools, from flipping war around.
I know.
And we, you know, we're inspired by the prophet's vision, Micah and Isaiah, beating swords into plows, spears into pruning hooks. So we said, well, we don't have a lot of swords in America, but we've got more guns than people. So maybe we can start to transform them. And now thousands of guns later, you know, we've been transforming these into garden tools and art, but it's also that proclamation. Every time we turn a gun into a garden tool, we are saying all things can be made new. And I tell my evangelical friends, this is what a gun looks like when it gets born again.
Shame.
And you know, every time we do it to metal, we're also saying this is true of human hearts too. Even someone who's killed another person is more than the worst thing that they've ever done. They are still made in the image of God, and lives can be transformed. So it's hopeful work. And you know, that beautiful passage that we love so much about beating swords into plows, it's interesting because it ends by saying, nation will not rise up against nation. People will study war no more. But the peace that the prophets proclaim doesn't come from the top down. It comes from the bottom up. It's not the presidents and kings and emperors and prime ministers that lead the way to peace. They're the ones that keep making wars. It's the people who get so fed up with death that they take things into their own hands and they begin to transform the weapons, and they also begin to transform the world. And it's a reminder, right, that, you know, as Abraham Heschel and so many people said, you know, that the prophets, we misunderstand them sometimes. We think that they were fortune tellers trying to predict the future, and that's not it. They weren't fortune tellers, they were truth tellers. And they weren't trying to predict the future, they were trying to change the future by waking us up to the present and saying it doesn't have to be this way. And they invite us into a different imagination, right? That even a piece of metal that has been designed to kill can be reimagined and repurposed and rethought. And so it's, you know, that invitation to kind of remake the world that's at the heart of our work. And I think it's, you know, around gun violence, but it's on every front. We've got to be casting a vision and the hope that God's love is bigger than our sin, than our violence, like on the cross through the resurrection, like Jesus triumphed over death. So anytime, John, we try to defend violence, we are betraying and we are contradicting and undermining the very gospel of Jesus, which is life is more powerful than death. Love triumphs over hatred, mercy over judgment. So hallelujah. I got to preaching there, brother.
You did a great job. You were protestifying. I love it. God, Shane, it's great. Okay, now we got a couple minutes left. I'm going to shift a little bit. You've been doing really great work. No, seriously, over the last few years about Christian nationalism. So I want you to try to briefly talk to us about it. Now, here's my take. Boy, this is rough. The Third Reich, how the Nazis used Christianity to advance their strategy and political platform of hatred, mass murder, genocide, and global domination. I think this is the normal, natural progression of the United States if you look at its history from the genocide of the indigenous to the enslaved peoples to blah, 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 Hiroshima, Vietnam, you know, Reagan in Central America, nuclear weapons, and now Trump and the Republicans and Fox News. We're on that trajectory. You know, Gandhi said, Shane, unless a democracy, he said this in 1921, unless a democracy moves toward nonviolence and becomes a nonviolent democracy, it has to move into fascism. He that was before Hitler. You've written a lot about the rise of Christian nationalism. You've been taking a lot of hits for talking about it. And so tell us about it and what we can do about it, because it's in all the churches in these days, and it's getting worse. Maybe that's what you've been talking about all along.
Yeah, well, so. I mean, there's sure been a trajectory of conversion for me on this. I mean, you know, when I was in high school, I was helping lead the See You at the Pole prayer campaigns where we would gather at the flagpole and pray to, you know, bring prayer back into public schools.
Oh, come on.
You know, but I want to say, you know, part of what I began to recognize is that I mean, to be really frank, you know, it doesn't feel like you should have to say this, but Jesus was not American. Jesus did not speak English. Jesus was not white. And as you begin to see the story of the gospel and the story of God, America is not the center, Jesus is. And something happens when we believe that America is God's messianic force in the world, that we have this kind of exceptionalism, a doctrine of discovery, a manifest destiny that's still being used to this day to try to justify the colonization of Gaza. So all of this is like, connected. And I think what happened for me is I actually began to come back to some of the core beliefs of my evangelical youth, like the idea that we're born again. I mean, that became a little cliche. It's been misused. But I think part of what Jesus is inviting us into is a bigger vision for family and for love that goes beyond our DNA and beyond biological family and extends to the farthest reaches of the world, right? That to be born again, you know, Mother Teresa said, sometimes our biggest problem is the circle we've drawn around our family is too small. It's too small. And that's the problem with nationalism, is we begin to believe that our people are more valuable than other people. And yet the idea of being born again means that if someone else's child is starving, it's as tragic as if it was my own child. If someone is suffering on the other side of our southern border, it's as tragic as if it was my own grandmother. If those kids in Gaza are just as precious as the kids in Israel or the kids, my own little baby Elijah, that same image of God is in them. And so I think part of this is about saying a love for the people of our own country is not a bad thing, but our love doesn't stop at borders. Our Bible doesn't say God so loved America. It says God so loved the world. And so we've got to have a love that's as big as God's love. And I also think this is also about power. John, you know, as we think of Christian nationalism, I heard someone say, you'll like this. They said, if you believe, as you read the temptations of Jesus in the desert, Jesus made all the wrong decisions, you might be a Christian nationalist, because that's exactly what many Christians are doing, is selling out to the, I mean, literally, it's as if they never read the scripture where Jesus says, what good is it to gain the whole world and forfeit your soul? I mean, we have evangelicals that aren't even gaining the world. They're just gaining a few seats on the Supreme Court and forfeiting their soul. They're, surrendering any moral credibility, any integrity in order to defend things that are utterly indefensible. And I want to say, like, I believe that Donald Trump is not beyond redemption and grace. And yet right now he's made a vocation out of the seven deadly sins. I mean, he's made a mockery of the fruit of the Spirit, undermines regularly every tenet of the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, and so, like, we look to Jesus and we see that Jesus is a direct confrontation to empire, to power, to the forces that are alive in our nation. And many people, when they say make America great again, they are saying make America white again. And it's very clear that this is about the fragility of power in a nation that is changing, and the folks that have been the power brokers, that is changing a little bit after the first Black president, after, you know, like the changing demographics of Congress and, you know, all of this. So this is around a fault line of race, and there are a lot of people who would like to go back to some kind of heroic romantic time in the past. But every Black person I know, they go, like, what part of American history do we want to go back to? You know, and I think that's kind of the question as we look at the state of our country. And it's a choice of love over fear. So I absolutely think this is a moment we have to stand on the promise of Scripture that perfect love casteth out fear, that fear and love are like opposing magnets. They push each other out, and fear pushes out love. Gives us another alternative to fear and scarcity and these people that are replacing us and all of this garbage that is so much about fear. And so the invitation is to imagine, what would our country look like if it was love rather than fear, that was the compelling force behind our policies on immigration. What would real justice look like? It sure wouldn't look like the death penalty. You know, how can we love our immigrant neighbors, our refugee neighbors, knowing that as we do that, we do it to Jesus? So this is not just a crisis of democracy. It certainly is that. I mean, it's not just a social or political crisis, but this is a deeply spiritual crisis. And American nationalism that's trying to camouflage itself as Christianity is not only a threat to democracy, but it's a threat to authentic Christianity, the real love for Jesus. And we saw that, you know, even recently as Bishop Buddy, a dear friend who, you know, we've collaborated with on all kinds of stuff. We've made her a cross, John, made out of a gun, you know, and Bishop Buddy just spoke the words of Jesus. And, you know, you can hear the reverb of the Beatitudes, blessed are the merciful, as she spoke to President Trump for mercy for immigrants and vulnerable neighbors. It was the gospel that she was proclaiming. And that evoked some of the worst principalities and powers, people that called her a witch and a sorceress, saying that she was compelled by the devil. And I always say, I've been saying, John, if you didn't like the 2-minute homily of Mary and Bubby Buddy that went viral, you're really not going to like the Sermon on the Mount. Or, you know, the Magnificat of Mary.
Exactly.
Allowed, you know, I mean, this is radical. Flip the world upside down stuff.
Wow, Shane Claiborne, thank you so much for all this amazing inspiration and that you're giving me. And we have to continue this conversation many times. And I wish you all the best. Thanks so much, Shane, for speaking with me today. Just to wrap up here, I want to thank all you friends for listening to this Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear many more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at www.beatitudecenter.org. Please consider offering a donation to support this free work. And if you can, leave a little positive feedback or review at NCR or Apple or Spotify or whatever platform you're using. Join me next week when I'll continue to explore these questions. I myself will reflect a little on Luke 10, how Jesus sent the 72 out ahead of them as lambs into the midst of wolves to proclaim God's reign, like Shane is doing today. And so I thank you all so much for listening. May the God of peace bless everyone. Keep on following the Nonviolent Jesus, and see you all next time. And thanks again, Shane.
Thank you, my brother.